Welcome to this 25th episode of the Neil's Rewind podcast on war and violence. My name is Anne van Maurik. This episode is concerned with the question, what is violence? And perhaps this seems as an odd question. Violence is the bombing of a city, the torturing of a war prisoner, or placing a knee into a neck during an arrest. Don't we know violence when we see it?
Highly extractive industries, right? Which are job generators, which produce tremendous wealth for investors, which create energy and resources, often at the expense of the lives of their employees. One might think of, for example, West Virginia in the United States, which has some labor protections. People have, for generations, had disproportionate degrees of cancerous infection.
This is Avi Sharma from the Center of Metropolitan Studies at the Technical University in Berlin, talking about slow violence, a term coined by Rob Nixon. Unlike spectacular violence, such as the bombing of a city, slow violence is harm that plays out over years or decades. Avi's example demonstrates that violence can be exerted by more than fists or weapons. How to address violence that happens out of sight, which has the potential to kill entire populations and destroy entire regions of the world? And how to address the more invisible forms of violence, such as institutionalized inequalities, exploitation and suppression? In the Neo, traditionally violence has been seen as an instrument of oppression and or liberation. Originally studying the history of the Second World War in the Netherlands and the then Dutch East Indies and Indonesia, the NEAD research focused on widespread physical violence against non-combatants. Violence was, in this context, essentially seen as, for example, killing, strategic bombing, collective rape, excessive imprisonment, and forced removal. To seek a deeper understanding of violence, in June 2022, the NEAD, together with the NIAS, the Netherlands Institute for Advanced Studies, organized a workshop on the question, what is violence? And who actually decides what counts as violence in the past, but also in the present and future? This episode features four scholars attending this workshop. Avi Sharma, Shinisha Maleshevic, who is a professor of sociology at the University College Dublin in Ireland, Tatjana Tinsmeyer, who is professor at the University of Wuppertal, and Ton Zwaan, who, as a sociologist and anthropologist on war and violence, testified for the Uyghur London Tribunal case. In their respective research, these scholars, all with different research interests and coming from different disciplines, use different understandings of violence. And as such, this podcast episode shows how our research interests give shape to specific working definitions of violence. In this Neil Rewind episode, they discuss how they characterize their own understanding of the concept. And let's start with this point of the different understandings of violence.
So, I mean, there is a common sense understanding of violence that everybody, has in their mind. We know if somebody's killed, that's a violence, and, kind of physical assaults and things like that. But the concept of violence has changed through time. We'll talk about that. And there is really no agreement, how far do you go? In some respects, it's a scalar concept. On one hand, let's say on the one side, everybody more or less agrees that it has something to do with physical, intentional interaction that results in injuries or death. But on the other side of that scale, there is no agreement. How far do you go? And particularly, it's very difficult to capture these more complex forms of violence that take time to have a kind of outcome, if you like. So historically that has changed. And there are different ways of how people, because obviously we don't agree on what violence is, we cannot agree on how to study.
This is Shinisha Maleshevic. He points out that scholars of war and violence all explicitly or implicitly use a narrow or a wide definition of violence.
So narrow concept of violence is really the one that most international organizations have traditionally operated with, which is intentionality. Somebody
wants to do this to another human being or an animal, obviously it can be any creature, and it has to do with physicality of it. It's essentially there has to be a physical injury, some sort of a visible, detectable outcome of that. So that's a kind of narrow one. And that has dominated much of the research, much of the kind of international institutions, debates. But I think since 1960s onwards, we started thinking beyond that and trying to develop kind of more wider understandings to capture this, you could say, 90% of what I would call violence. So that's, you know, Johan Galtung came up with that idea of structural violence, trying to see, you know, this narrow concept of violence doesn't capture. So in a sense that his intention was to capture all these other forms of violence. And then we have other people like Žižek talks about systemic violence, linking it to capitalism. And then we have in sociology a lot of different perspectives, like a symbolic violence by Bourdieu and others who try to see, you know, how we can really study, analyze all these other forms of violence.
Right. So since the 1960s, the Norwegian sociologist Johan Galtung coined the term structural violence, which signifies the systematic ways in which groups are obstructed from equal access to opportunities, goods and services, and thereby preventing them from meeting their basic needs. Sociologists have tried to widen the classical understanding of violence, Sinisha argues. However, he also warns for a definition too wide.
So if it's too wide, it's also a problem, because then everything becomes violent. So it's not very helpful if you say capitalism is violence. And, I mean, obviously capitalism contributes to violence and many other things, but if inequality equals violence, then, you know, what are we gaining conceptually in that sense? So I try to find a kind of middle road, which is not too narrow, but also not extremely wide, but it's wide enough to capture varieties of violence.
This danger of inflation of the concept of violence is one of the reasons why Ton Zwaan tends to think about violence in the classical way.
If you look at the daily meaning of violence, I think what comes back time and again is the idea of the threat or the use of physical force and coercion. And for me, this daily meaning, so to speak, has always been more or less the leading meaning of the word of violence. There have been long discussions, we also had discussions here, about the meaning of violence. It has been broadened very much, all sorts of behavior. What is lost there, to my mind, is that it is not distinctive anymore, that it may seem to you in a certain mood that everything is loaded with violence. I regret that. I don't think that's a good thing. I feel for a certain narrow and clear meaning in the sense of the threat or the use of force. And that points immediately to another connection there. This is done by people against other people. So violence has to do with relations between people, individually and in groups. And that points immediately, to my mind, to the concept of power. You could say, I think, violence is the ultimate means of power. And killing another person, or maiming, or wounding, or whatever, these are the ultimate violent deeds. So if you want to understand violence, you have to study power relations between people.
So there is scholarly debate on the scope of the concept. Where does violence begin and where does it end? Not only currently it's hard to unambiguously define violence. What counted as violence is also subject to change over time, Sinisha argues.
Today, you know, we say certain acts are violent if they are legally defined as such. But you have acts which would be ordinarily considered violent, like martial arts, you know, boxing, cage fighting. This is violent, but it's not legally violent because there is a consent between these people. Also, some practices like that you see more often now with reality TV, where people can be violent to each other, but because it's a consensual, it's not. Or not to mention sadomasochistic, you know, practices, which, you know, this is. So we do kind of change the concept of how we define violence. And historically, you will see things like blasphemy, heresy, where it could be violence. You know, this is a violence against God, and it's a sinful behavior, often was punished by death. Today, that's unthinkable. I mean, at least in this part of the world where we live. Which shows us how the concept of violence shifts historically. You know, it is very much situational, it's contextual and historically defined and culturally defined as well. It's certain practices are still outlawed in some parts of the world, and in other parts of the world, people have completely different things. Let's say wife battery, abuse, and also these things were not considered to be violence until fairly recently, historically speaking. Now we they are very clearly regulated. So it is an interesting thing how the concept changes as societies change and transform.
My question then would be, does that also mean that it isn't violence, or that it is not perceived as violence in the legal system?
Yes, in legal, but also legal systems reflect values, the normative frameworks, and legal systems change to accommodate how society is changed. I mean, homosexuality was considered until very recently a big kind of legal something that had to be you were sent to prison essentially for these activities. Now we don't do that, but because the values have changed, so societies have become more acceptable of different sexual practices, and now we don't do that. But in other parts of the world, people do that. So it's like it's not So it's historically and culturally specific, and that will not change in that sense. The violence will continue. We will continue to redefine violence in that sense.
An important issue that comes to the fore when talking about a narrow versus a wide definition is perpetratorship. Structural violence or slow violence do not always have a clear perpetrator. Who is, for example, the perpetrator of long-term pollution or climate change? In such a context, when violence is collective and thereby less visible, Ton stresses the importance of intention behind harm and death in order to consider it as violence.
In these sort of situations, very great numbers of people are involved. Many people don't oversee what they do themselves. They're used to the small jobs or the labors they have to do, the organization. So it is seldom, to my mind, that people oversee in what sort of processes they are involved. So you should be distinguishing maybe to say intended destruction and unintended destruction.
Whereas Ton emphasizes that the intentionality of violence is critical, Avi Sharma argues the opposite.
There is very clear evidence that some people who are involved in, for example, highly extractive industries recognize that they are enacting violence on people. But I think, for example, an employee, a guy working on an oil rig, doesn't think about the effects of his practice on the planet or on his neighbors or on indigenous communities, by and large. It's not an intentional act of violence. What happens very clearly, though, the kind of consequence is an act of violence, right? And so intentionality strikes me as not a critical dimension of the study of violence. And I think the fact that we focus on intentionality actually leads us to miss or ignore huge swaths of, the world that we ourselves are participating in. And our own complicity in the production of violence. Now, is that to say that we should ignore people who are actively perpetrators of violence, those people who systematically murder or rape or enact policies which are directed at killing? Of course not. I think those are absolutely critical to recognize and engage with. I think simultaneously humans are smart enough to hold two things in their minds at one time, right? And to say, if you actively rape or murder or, you know, commit war crimes against humanity or, you know, genocidal practice, that's something we need to interrogate and address and prosecute. But at the same time, we also need to recognize that that is not, in fact, how most vulnerabilities are produced, how most violence occurs, and how most human death in situations of extreme immiseration is enacted.
Another form of violence which often lacks obvious intentionality and clear perpetratorship is hunger. Tatjana Tensmeyer, a historian of hunger under occupation, emphasizes that hunger can have both direct and indirect agency. In World War II, for example, many people died because of Nazi racial discrimination in feeding, which is a direct form of violence. However, current hunger in the global south has no unambiguous agency.
If I'm not mistaken, then the Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, mentioned that already in 2020, so during the pandemic, but before the war in Ukraine, or at the start of the pandemic and before the Russian war in Ukraine, between 720 and 800 million people, especially in the global south, were suffering from either hunger or malnutrition. Even those who will survive this hunger, if the hunger and the scarcity and the malnutrition sets in at a very early stage of people's life, yeah, as children, of course this has tremendous consequences for their whole lives, yeah, for their development, and this of course is a kind of structural violence. Here it is much more difficult to say who is causing this violence to a certain person. Now, it's much more structural. Of course, we can say much about the structures that kind of produce this kind of violence.
To gain a more profound understanding of how people, structures and organizations contribute to violence, Sinisha sees violence as a social process. In his book, The Rise of Organized Brutality, A Historical Sociology of Violence, he came up with a working definition of violence. In his working definition, Sinisha stresses three important points to perceive violence. Firstly, violence being a social process. Secondly, he goes beyond the notion of intentionality. And thirdly, he mentions coercion, which he acknowledged as being integral to violence.
So I try to emphasize it's a social process. So it's not something fixed. It's not an event. It takes time to see outcomes of violent acts. It can be intentional. It can be unintentional, like hunger in many cases. But the results can be devastating. And we can think of an example also of genocide of Native Americans. You know, most of it was not even intentional. In some instances, it was intentional when they were poisoning wells and giving them, you know, some moving them from one area into desert to die. But in many cases, they died from disease, which Europeans brought, and it wasn't intentional, but it was still kind of, the outcomes were very clear even then. So you keep doing this and you know the outcome will be there. And coercively imposed behavioral change is important because that means that you're doing something against your will. That is important for violence, you know, so somebody is imposing, forcing you to do something. So that's, I think, and the outcomes can be anything from physical, mental, emotional damage to death. So that's what I was trying to capture, a variety of these things. And it's not easy, again, how do you measure kind of mental pressure, mental torture? I mean, these are not easy things to do. Historically, it's impossible in some respects, because even with injuries, we know, let's say, in court cases, let's say domestic violence, many injuries heal quickly. So it's just very difficult to prove that. Obviously, if you look at what kind of violence took place a few hundred years ago, a few thousand years ago, this is very difficult to find out. But I don't think we should give up on that, you know, because these are all varieties of how violence transpires.
Tatjana acknowledges the importance of a working definition to prevent working with an implicit definition. She emphasizes the importance of temporality in defining violence, as some forms of violence, such as hunger, are often without a clear temporal demarcation.
Thinking what my, not my definition, but my part of the definition, or the thing that I would like to emphasize, is that violence often has a special temporality. Yeah, and when we especially focus on the media, then this temporality often is not that much in the present, because you either have media coverage on special aspects of mass violence, which is usually a short time frame, or you have like the ongoing war, Russian war in Ukraine, then the time frame is something that is, it is still open, the war is still going on. And I think as a historian who is much working on hunger, there is a different temporality to this. The beginning is much more difficult to be addressed. The end is much more difficult to be addressed. And there is no that now it starts and now it is over. But of course you have long-term processes, and you have very kind of special moments when malnutrition becomes real hunger. Yeah, and again, it is difficult to say. With fighting, you can say, this is the first bomb that has been dropped. This is the first shot that has been fired. But with hunger, when do you have been the first time hungry? And when is the point that from scarcity it turned really into hunger? Yeah, so there are different forms of violence, have different forms of temporality. And the history of hunger can maybe teach us something on the temporality of violence, on different temporalities of violence.
This temporality is one of the reasons, she argues, that people tend to focus more on spectacular violence. Hunger influenced the everyday lives of many people during World War II, as well as in today's society. Yet we, as a society, tend to focus more on spectacular violence.
It has to do with economies of attention. And economies of attention are often triggered by spectacular pictures. If the violence is not happening in our societies, then we get to know about them via the media, and then it's often pictures that kind of trigger this economies of attention. Going along with this, if we think about past violence, then memory has become very much the mode of engaging with the past. And the consequence of this is that if things happen at a given date, like this is the first bombing, this is the day a war started, then you have special pictures for that, past and present, and you have a date for that. And then, so to speak, memory sets in. And memory has something it could deal with. But hunger, usually it's difficult to say when does it start. So you do not have at first the spectacular pictures. And when you have the spectacular pictures, like from World War II, like the so-called Biafra babies and others, then it is of course a question of dignity. Do we show these pictures? And how do we deal with these pictures? But anyway, they again, these pictures kind of can motivate memory. But what we have been talking before about hunger, with the special temporality, you usually do not have these kind of pictures. So why is hunger often not that much remembered? I think it has to do with its temporality and with economies of attention that need pictures. And pictures and dates. And I think the consequence of taking these two developments together is that there is many things happen or happened in the past. As I'm a historian, I would kind of focus on that, where because of the temporality and because the economies of attention tend to focus on things that have a date, many things that happened in the past kind of drift out of focus. And this has to do with the mode that we less and less tend to history as such, or we tend to focus on memory. And I think this may lead to shortcomings, because if you do not have a date and if you do not have a spectacular picture, these things kind of drift out of our attention. And as a historian, I really think this is problematic.
Tatiana warns us not to limit our understanding by only focusing on spectacular violence, but to also try to see the violence that occurs out of sight. Violence without a clear temporal demarcation, without a clear responsibility and visibility, might be less sensational. It is definitely not less harmful. So far, we have talked about past violence and present violence. How about violence of the future? Let's focus briefly on the future with Avi. Different current tendencies such as cyber technology, climate change, deforestation, and pollution call for the question, what are the changing forms and natures of violence?
You know, it's not like we're moving into the future. It seems to me that in many ways we still inhabit a past which has existed for four centuries, right? The kind of conflictual nature of nation-state relations, the kind of patriarchies, the kind of gender logics, the kind of property relationships, the asymmetries between global north and south, that is, you know, essentially metropolitan and colonial states. Those things absolutely persist. So I don't know why we're talking about the future as though we don't know what will happen, right? The same thing is happening, that has been happening for three centuries in many ways. Now, will artificial intelligence and so on and so forth change that? I think people in science and technology studies would say, you know, technology changes things, but not necessarily in fundamental or structural ways, right? The practice of violence is potentially different, but the kind of structural logics of violence haven't necessarily changed, right? And we see this every day in violence enacted on women, on indigenous persons, on children, on the exploitation of people in global southern space.
Seeing how expert opinions on forms, variations, and definitions of violence diverge, it seems fitting to end this episode with more questions rather than answers. As Avi noted, we, as a society, inhabit structures that allow some people to be protected from violence, while others are routinely exposed to it. Inequalities are enshrined in language, customs, rules, and laws and contribute to violence, which calls for the question, how are we ourselves contributing to these structures? Given that we are embedded within these mental, cultural, and historical structures, what does this mean for our view on what is violence and what is not? In other words, which violence are we not seeing? What is violence if we do not recognize it as such because we're used to it? Thanks for listening to this special 25th episode of the Neil Rewind podcast on war and violence. This episode is a product of a collaboration. In 2021, the Neil Research Department engaged in an effort to consider how the international research agenda in this field might be fed with new questions and fresh approaches. For this purpose, an international fellow group was created at the NIALS, Netherlands Institute of Advanced Studies, in cooperation with the NIALS core team, War and Society. Next to this group of scholars, credits go to Thijs Bouwknecht, with whom I interviewed Ton Zwaan. Ismay Tamis, Peter Romein and Kylie Thomas of the NIALS and Roel Frocking of Utrecht University advised me on the content of this episode. Roy Roosendaal made the intro tune, and the communication is done by Katie Digan and cataloging by Femke Jaapkops.